Okay, so this is what my mother did. I'm going to ask her. She won't deny it. She and my dad were going out somewhere. I don't know. Didn't care. But my mother, besides, my brothers and I need a babysitter. And this alone, this is a debatable point. I'm 13 years old. Plenty grown enough to handle the job. In fact, the neighbors pay me to babysit their kids. Mom, we don't need a babysitter. The mother's got to raise the game and push matters from intolerable to crazy ridiculous. What does she do? What does she do? She asked my friend Lori to come over and babysit us. Lori, in the same grade I'm in, a mere 9 months older than me, a girl who I help with her homework, bicycles over to our house. Are you kidding me? My mom was like, that Lori, she's very responsible. To the hell, to the no. But then Lori puts her game face on, starts him with this imperious attitude.
I want everyone in bed by 9:30 or there's going to be trouble. And that goes for you too, Glenn.
A what?
And if anyone gives me any lip, I know the phone number where your parents are staying.
Now, do I feel angry, hurt, unappreciated for my contributions? No. I don't. I feel pity and sorrow. See, these are my brothers. They have lived their entire lives under my command. And to imagine some girlie from down the street, someone they barely know, is going to roll up and be in charge of this?
Glenn, did you hear what I said?
I don't remember what I led with. It could have been the sonic screaming brother chorus. Maybe the wet really surprised. Perhaps even the Jell-O brother butter Crisco batter battle. I do recall that I didn't lift a finger. Just whispered commands. And I recollect as well that a mere 18 minutes on, Lori was dialing that number, screaming because nobody picked up. We watched her jump back on her bicycle and waved as she pedaled away fast as she could go. Again, I took no joy or pleasure from these naturally occurring chain of events. But the next time Mom and Dad went on a night for the town, and I mentioned they might consider paying me the money they were gonna pay Lori, there wasn't a whole lot of negotiation. Today on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, High and Mighty. Amazing stories from real people finding their own way to speak their own truth to their own power. My name is Glenn Washington. Please cease and desist from your malfeasance. Because this is Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Our first story today from Steve Wiles is about one simple decision that turned out to be not so simple at all. Snap Judgment.
From a young boy, all I remember of my father is how close we were, which is the irony, I suppose. We were very, very close. We were practically inseparable. The village we grew up in was a coal mining village. Most all the boys of my age, their fathers were all miners. It always seemed to be our destiny, even as small boys playing out on Colliery Row, or Pit Row as it was known locally. All through my young childhood, I was brought up on the understanding, rightly or wrongly, that my life would be spent down a coal mine. I expected, even the day I started work at the coal mine, I thought I'd be there for life. And I thought that any sons that I had would also be following me down the mine in a long-standing tradition. And I'd never contemplated doing anything else but coal mining. And I couldn't wait. You know, the minute we went down, that was an immensely proud moment for myself. I was with my dad. The miners at the pit used to call me, my dad's name was Ian, and the miners used to call me Young Ian because we were basically, we're like two peas in a pod, which basically means we look identical. Yeah, I had a very high level of trust I had to have because my life would depend on it, and my co-workers' lives depended on it also. We had to watch each other's back. We were always aware that at any time there could be an incident, whether that be a roof fall, an explosion. The strike was beginning to be spoken about down the mine amongst the men. There'd been rumblings saying that the National Union of Mine Workers was going to ballot its members for a national strike, and we were all asked to assemble in the canteen. One of the union delegates was in there, and he told us that the government was planning to close 20 pits with a loss of 20,000 jobs, and he wanted a show of hands in favour of strike action. Union representatives said that the show of hands looked in favour for strike action. I disagreed with it, and I commented to the guy next to me. I said, well, I didn't think it was in favour of a strike, and he commented saying that he didn't think it was either. But nevertheless, there was a group of hardliners that decided they were going to picket the gates at that time. In the community, they have this moral obligation where you don't cross picket lines. That's bred into the socialist remit right from the get-go, really. And I was still living at home with my father then. When I went home the following morning, my dad was up. And I questioned my dad, who was a stalwart for the union. We was told there would be, at some point, a national ballot. And he said, we don't need a national ballot, we're out on strike, and that's it. Well, that's, to me, wasn't any good. That wasn't democracy. All he'd ever say was, you don't cross picket lines. He wouldn't even enter into a debate even about it. During the 6 months that I was actually off work and out on strike, my mind and my heart and my feelings were filled with nothing more than the strike. And my thoughts were that I was really against the strike. I needed to go back. It was just a matter of plucking the courage and the guts to actually pick the phone up and do it. My father made it clear. He told me, he said that no son of his is going to no scab is going to live under his roof. That was the term he used. My dad's opinion is that if I'm going to continue working, I'm not welcome under his roof. It did play a heavy toll on my mind. I wasn't able to think about anything else, really. Part of the hesitation was how my relationship with my father would be, the feelings between me and my dad. It wasn't something I could just decide on a whim and do. It had a lot of consequence. And another part of it was the fear of retribution from the rest of the miners. Bearing in mind, in our local village, there'd be 500 or 600 people that actually worked at the mine. Every night, every lunchtime, every tea time on the local news, it'd be filled with nothing but people having bricks thrown through the windows, cars set on fire, even children attacked in some places, just because the father had gone back to work.
The police knew the pickets would return with a vengeance today.
The number of men working here earlier this week was 16, but 5 men have stayed at home because they say 3 of their group were beaten up by pickets last night.
Police came under a hail of missiles from a group of miners. Burning barricades have appeared in rural Yorkshire to block access roads to pits. On 2 occasions, petrol bombs have been found. Since the strike began, the injury toll has topped 800.
Had been classed as a civil war by members of the government. They say it was a civil war at the time, and it was quite bloody. And to be fair, that's one thing that kept me from contacting the mine. Anybody that wanted to contact the management, we had a direct line number anyway. Or so it was led to believe that we had a direct line number, but it went through a switchboard, and that switchboard was monitored by, sympathisers to the strike. So anybody that contacted the coal mine, their names were passed on to the National Union of Mine Workers leadership locally. So it was well known who was contacting the mines beforehand.
I decided to go back to work
albeit 6 months into the Domain strike, because I waited for a national ballot, as did a lot of other people, because that's what our rule book said. You know, if that ballot had been in favour for strike action, like it or lump it, we would have been out on strike, because that is democracy. And we never actually got it. It never came. Once that decision was made, I went into the hallway where the telephone was, and I got the number for the pit, the mine. And I was asked what my name was. Who was speaking, please? So I told him it was Stephen Wiles. Do you want a secure line? So I said, well, yes, I suppose so. So he rang me back. I said, like, Gaffer, I want to come back to work. I've been against the strike from the start. And I was surprised when he said, well, we're aware of the situation with your father, but we can get you into the mine if you want to come in. But you can't just walk in. Obviously, it's not safe. We'll have to arrange for the police to contact you as regards being escorted in. So at that, we ended the call. And that's when, I mean, my hand was shaking holding the phone, but after I put the phone down, the feeling, I mean, I felt physically sick, because now I've done it, there's no going back now. I've got to follow it through, even if I have a change of heart later. Because, I mean, I was scared stiff. I'd seen the images on the news. I wasn't naive. I knew what the outcome could possibly be. Going to bed the night before, knowing that I was going to be picked up the following morning by the escorted bus, my head was all over the place. I'd got what we call collie wobbles, really feeling nervous and tense. And every time I opened my eyes, it hit me like a brick. You know, I think, oh, crikey, in the morning, I'm, you know, things are going to change, probably for the worst. I got up at crack of dawn, something like 4 o'clock. Baked egg and beans is the last thing that I was wanting at that particular time, I can tell you. I didn't really want anything. I wanted to be able to keep it down if I had. At 5:15, there was a knock at the door. Opened the door and there's two policemen there, and there was quite a few policemen behind them as well on the pathway. I can tell you, I can feel it now just even recalling it. It felt like I was going to the gallows. It really did. Because the pathway was probably 25, 30 feet long to the gate. And I can't recall hearing any other noises at all. It was all like slow motion. A police van
pulled up outside the house,
followed by the bus, which was covered with weld mesh all the way around the windows. And then behind it was another police van. And this bus pulled up, the front sliding doors opened, and that's where I saw the driver and his mate stood at the front of the bus. Both had got crash helmets on, which really, I mean, that alone frightened me. But the man that was actually stood at the front, his assistant, had got a baseball bat in his hand. And what he said, "I'll be with me for the rest of my days," I think he said, "if ever the bus gets overrun, there are baseball bats in the racks above your head." Well, that kind of really got my heart racing. But I never felt I'd done the wrong thing. It's just, I knew I'd done the right thing. It was just getting through it. The route the bus was taking was about 2.5 miles. Going down the final lane towards the pit bridge, the driver shouted down that it looks like it's a big turnout today, lads. And that quarter of a mile was lined either side, 5 deep, with miners, all screaming and shouting.
The miners were attempting to block the access road to the pit.
With just one row of policemen. The terminology, thin blue line, really played a part there. All linked arm in arm, holding these crowds back from overrunning the bus. They were chanting mainly scab. Scab, scab, scabs is the main word. All of us on the bus, we were together, but the nearest way I can describe it is like zombies, if you like. We were just sat staring into space, thinking of what we'd done, what we were doing, and what it had meant, and how our life has changed, and wondering, in fact, more than anything, wondering, would it ever get back to normal? Would life ever get back to normal like it was before the strike? You know that most of the village and other villages, outlying villages around you, are baying for your life. I saw my father because he was stood right next to the pit gates. And he was looking at the bus and he was shouting along with the rest of them. He knew I was on that bus. When I first saw my father on the picket line, that really, you know, I thought, well, we're divided really by the thin walls of a bus, but in reality, we're divided by life itself and by a lot thicker wall than that. But I still had, I mean, I loved my dad. I never stopped loving him. But I saw him and I thought, this is going to hurt him, not only because his son's gone back, but be a little bit embarrassing for him as well. I took that bus to that picket line every day for 6 months. You know, I mean, during the strike, obviously, I was a prisoner in the home. We had a brick through the window in the dead of night. I had a death threat at the letterbox. I was the 14th one to go back. And by, I would say, the Christmas of 84, there would be, at best guess, probably about 70 or 80 people back by then. And between Christmas and March, when the strike finished, they were coming back in droves. So it was practically 80% actually inside the colliery by the time the strike had finished. When the strike was called off by the union leader, you know, we were quite apprehensive at that, because although 80% of the workforce had come back, the rest of them was going to come back. They were the diehards. But when the elk came back, they come marching over the bridge with the union banner, brass band playing. You know, we were certain, just looking at them, that, yeah, they were angry. They felt betrayed. And one of the first people that came through into there was my dad. I saw him. And that is the closest I'd stood to him for 6 months. I did look at him in the face, and I made a point of doing that. He looked at me, but he didn't, if you know what I mean. He kind of looked straight through me. He just refused to have anything to do with me. The funny thing, really, even after the strike had finished, my dad became a councillor in his local village, and some of the people that were going to see him were people that had actually gone back to work at the pit. And he spoke to them as if nothing had ever happened. He was just as friendly with them then as he was before the strike. And I know it would have hurt more for me because I was his son. But I always thought, you know, give it a month or two, then my dad will come round and we'll start talking, and life will get back to normal. As the months went by, it became clear that it was going to take a lot longer. So months turned into years, years turned into decades, and still his resolve was the same, that he wouldn't have anything to do with me. Well, I remember getting a call on my mobile phone in the office at work, and I think I knew. And then it was my sister saying, unfortunately, my dad passed away in the early hours of this morning. He died on a Tuesday, and he spoke to my sister on the Sunday, saying that he's got very little time left on this earth. He felt that he was going to pass away in the next few days, and started telling her what arrangements he wanted. But he never, in all that time, he was certain he was going, but he never actually said mentioned my name. And I said, you know what? I lost my dad 30 years ago, essentially, because of me making that decision to go back to work. I couldn't say at all that I ever stopped loving my dad. I didn't stop loving him, even though that love was one-sided. Up to the day he died, if he'd knocked on my door and said, look, let's put it behind us and move on, I would have done that willingly. That brought an end to it, really. Not an end I would have liked. The strike crucified the coaling industry in the UK. The government just rapidly sped up the closure programme, and it turned out to be more, not just 20 as it was initially, it went to 70, and then pits were closing every year. When the mine closed, everybody drifted off. Some, sadly, never worked again, like my dad. The village died along with the coal mine. I remember I went back to the village in 2004. I actually went to visit the old pit row where I was brought up, just for nostalgia and just to reminisce a little bit. There's still a couple of miners live on there. And I got out the car outside what was my dad's house. It was a cold morning, because I remember seeing my breath, so it was a frosty morning. And just reminiscing what I used to do and coming out to the end of the yard as a young boy and playing in the dirt on the roadsides there. And that's when I noticed this old guy come out from a couple of doors down. And he stood at the end of his yard and he saw me. He must have recognised me straight away. And I looked at him and he looked straight at me and he says, "What are you doing here, you scab?"
Find out more about Steve's story and a link to a book he wrote about his life, A Scab Is No Son of Mine, on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Leon Morimoto. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the high and mighty episode. Put on your running shoes. We'll be right back in just a moment. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from WNYC, the High and Mighty episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today, Snap is standing up to some powerful forces. Next up, Bill Hillman rocks his tale live in Chicago. Get ready for a choose-your-own-adventure story like none other.
I had a violent childhood. I got in a lot of street fights. I was in gangs. That all made it really hard to learn. And I had a lot of trouble learning how to read. And I struggled. I didn't read an entire novel until I got into junior college. And this teacher started getting me to read Ernest Hemingway's work. And I decided, to hell with it, I'm going to read a whole book. So I strolled the halls of the library. I found The Sun Also Rises, Ernest Hemingway's debut novel, picked it up off the shelf, sat down, and just started reading. And this is a book about these expat Americans in the 20s who traveled to the Running of the Bulls in Pamplona. And they had this crazy adventure. And as I'm reading it, it felt like he was talking directly to me. And I read that book in 6 hours, and when I closed the book, I decided I was going to go to Spain, and I was going to run with the Bulls. 3 years after I read that book, I was standing on Estafeta Street, the same place Ernest Hemingway had watched from 80 years before. I started to hear this like chaotic sort of rumble in the distance, and so I started walking towards it. And sure enough, it's Town Hall. It's where you're supposed to wait for the Running of the Bulls. And when a police officer turned their back, I snuck in through the barricades and I got on the course. And I decided I was going to run the curve, also known as Hamburger Wall or Dead Man's Corner. This is like the most dangerous place on the course. It's a really stupid idea. So the rocket goes off, which means the Bulls are in the street. And I hear this rumble just moving towards me. And everybody's panicking. People are flying past, screaming, scared. And the rumble just starts growing and growing until the ground starts shaking and the buildings are shaking. And suddenly this rocket, this black sort of rocket, just shoots into view. And the lead bull had bucked the runner. And he is floating over the bull's head. And he's screaming. And the herd and him, they all just crash and fall into the corner. And out of my periphery, I see a motion, and I'm like, what is it? I turn, and there's a gigantic steer that hugged the inside of the corner, and it's coming straight for me. It is like 5 feet from me, and at the last second, I dive backward and kind of push off its side, and the people who are running next to me, it just tramples them, and they both scream out, and I stop, and I like try to help them, and then I look up, and there's one bull left at the curve, and it turns and looks at me, and this lone bull just starts coming for me. And I take off running. I never ran faster in my entire life. Now, that first run had such an impact on me, I knew that my life had forever changed. I came back every year for 10 years. And over those years, I started to learn about the run, about the tradition, and I learned about this thing called running on the horns, which is the run in front of a bull. And what happens is the bull picks up on your cadence, and if it likes it, it follows you, and it links with you, and it'll follow you anywhere you go. When you run on the horns, it is such an intense rush. It's like being connected to the fiercest, most majestic beast on earth. And it's like catching a perfect wave. It's like summiting Everest. It is absolute glory. And over the years, I started to be able to do that little by little. And I started to get the respect of the Spanish runners and people started taking a notice that I could run. At the same time, I kept seeing all these foreigners, all these tourists that were coming, and they were basically just messing up the run. They didn't know what they're doing. They're just like me when I first came. They had no idea what was going on, and they were getting people hurt. So I thought, you know, I need to start writing about this. I need to write so I can inform and maybe help sort of clean up the street. And I did. I wrote one for Outside Magazine, and later some people decided to publish it as a book, as a survival guide, sort of the do's and don'ts of bull running. It was just amazing. It was like everything, my whole life was sort of like coming to a pinnacle. Like, I finally became an author. I was going to Spain to run for the 10th time. I was just feeling great. And on July 9th, I was running in Pamplona. And there's one thing in my guide. If you get near a lone bull, if you're a first-time runner, you need to just run away. But it's sort of a paradox, because for guys like me who run for many years, it's like the ultimate is to run on the horns of a lone bull. It's like the most intense, the most exhilarating thing you can do in the run. So I was running that day on the 9th, and sure enough, a lone bull appears, and I approach him, and everything's great. You know, he acknowledges me right away. There's two really legendary runners running with me, leading this bull up the street. Everything's going great, running, and I look back, and there they are, all the tourists, and they're panicking. And they're freaking out, and they're right on me, and I have nowhere to go. And the thing about panic, if you're too close to the panic, you're just as screwed as the people who are panicking. I tripped up in them. I ended up falling right in front of the bull, and this 1,200-pound black Spanish fighting bull with dagger-like horns swooped in. His horn pierced my mid-thigh. He lifted me into the air. I fell off, fell back down to the stones. I was on my back, and I knew not to get up, because you're not supposed to get up if you fall. So I stayed on my back, but my knee was a little up, and he gored me again. And when he gored me under the leg, he just kind of let out this, like, seethe. He was like, oh. And the medics pulled me under the barricades. I looked down, and it looked like my leg was swollen like a balloon on my thigh. And in the center of that balloon, there was a baseball-sized hole. And it was like somebody had scooped a whole handful of flesh out of it. The little hole that was under my leg was just streaking, gushing blood out of my leg. And it was going straight down my leg and filling my shoe. And I knew about the femoral artery. And if it's severed, you got 2 minutes before you die. And I'm thinking, it's got to be the artery. I'm panicking and I'm thinking, is this how I die? Right here, 30 yards from the freaking Ernest Hemingway statue. I'm thinking about Ernest Hemingway. I'm like, you got me into this, man. And suddenly, out of nowhere, Michael Hemingway, who's Ernest Hemingway's great-grandson, just miraculously appears. We know each other. And he's like, he's not like what you would think of like as like a Hemingway, like a big, burly Hemingway. He's like kind of like this skinny little torpy guy with a high-pitched voice. And he's like, my God, Bill, you've been gored. And I'm like, yeah, Michael, I know, man. Ask the medics if it's the artery, you know? And that kid, man, he's only 18 years old. He was really there for me. He kneeled down beside me, took my hand, man. He was there for me. And he's like, Bill, the horn, it brushed the artery, but it didn't sever it. He's smiling at me. He's like, I'm here. You're going to be okay.
Woo!
so much, Bill Hillman, for sharing with the Snap. Now, you better believe that Bill hasn't stopped running. I have a link to his survival guide and everything else he's written on our website, snapjudgment.org, along with info about where to catch the Seven Deadly Sins storytelling event. Check it out. That piece was produced by Anna Adlerstein. Now, when Snap Judgment returns, we unveil the results of a secret excavation that is not right next to where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, a book of mysteries that is part of no one's Bible. In just a moment, with Snap Judgment, the High and Mighty episode continues. Stay tuned. I knew I wasn't supposed to play favorites. You have to understand, I was good to all my children. They were my joy. The boys. So strong, stronger than their father. They'd clank their little wooden swords. Papa, watch. Papa, look, Papa! The people at the temple would say, 10 sons. Surely he's blessed by God. And I loved them all. But then my wife gave me the baby girl. I named her Lila, after her grandmother. And like men from generations past, I was smitten. Her feet, they never touched the ground, never. I'd even make the aunties wrap her in cloth so I could take her with me on my rounds. They'd laugh and they'd shout, "You can't give milk, who do you think you are?" Well, they were right about that. So I'd have to give her back to the nursemaid to be fed until she reached her fat arms out for me and we were off again to the water's edge, to the bazaar, to the temple, where I would kneel and thank God. I thanked him for the fields, thanked him for these sons, for the prettiest wife the world has ever known, and I thanked him for my Lila, my light, my breath. And that night, just as every other night, I heard him. "You are a good man. You have kept my commands. You give to the poor. You have built me my temple." This voice spoke not in a dream, not in the wind, no. I heard him the same way you hear your brother, the same way you hear the neighbor's gossip or the widow's prayers. I heard God. I spoke to him, and this God spoke back to me. "I am well pleased," he said. "I'm your humble servant," I answered, because I was his humble servant. I listened, and he told me about the setting of the foundation of the world, the breath of the wind, the mighty Leviathan roaming his sea. The people called me learned amongst men. But God's knowledge was not mine alone. I spoke in the temple everything the Lord told me. Men sought my advice before purchasing lands. Women asked who would be a good match for their sons. My wife, she held her head high in the marketplace, servants trailing behind her. "Look up on Job," the people proclaimed. "He is blessed of God." One night, I rocked my Lila to sleep and I placed her upon 2 dozen cushions. And then I knelt to pray. I began with thanks. I spoke of the appreciation, as I have done every single day since I was 15 years old. Then I waited for the Lord. I waited. I spent the night waiting, praying on my knees, and I did not hear him. Only when the cock crowed did I understand morning had come. Still, the Lord had not spoken a single silent night. What right did I, a mere mortal, have to expect the God of the universe to keep my schedule? The Lord does as the Lord will. Then I heard the running footsteps, a sharp knock on my door. A moment! Just a moment. Do not wake the baby girl. I opened to see my good and faithful servant Abel trembling.
Master, he said, we are lost.
He told me of the fires that had swept away my farms, destroying not only the crops in the field, but our granaries as well. I lifted the man to his feet. Yes, I told him. This is terrible, but think upon the others and their losses. They had so much less. Praise God for his mercy.
No, Master. Only your fields were touched.
Of course, this made no sense. My holdings were vast, yes, but interspersed with the crops of countless others. Show me. I left the baby with her nursemaid, and we made for the farms. And there I saw it. Field after field laying bare. But where my field still reeked of charred ash, my neighbor's field adjoining it remained untouched. Ripe. Green. Mocking. Not a stalk of wheat singed. Symmetrical squares of destruction. A surgeon's scalpel had cut my labor from the earth. No arsonist could have been so deft. I fell at once to my knees. I pulled my servant to the ground as well, and there we prayed. Lord God, if I have offended you, please reveal my transgression, and I will resolve to see it repaired. This I swear. And I waited. We waited together. Bits of ash from the newly wasted fields raining down upon us like a fine black dust. And there came no answer. As we returned, the people whispered at my passing, and whom my wife demanded to see me alone. Only when everyone had left, she hissed, "What sin have you done? I'm blameless, woman. The Lord does as the Lord wills." I bent again in prayer that night. I thanked him for his goodness. I thanked him for his mercy. I begged that he end his silence. But again the cock crowed, welcoming the sun after the silent night. Then footsteps knocking.
"Master, master, we are lost. All of the cattle, the oxen, the sheep, the goats have sickened and died in the night."
I fell to my knees and retched.
"Master."
No, I did not need Rye to confirm his report. I tore the gown from my back and demanded he bring me sackcloth and ashes, the raiment of mourning. I covered my face in the ash of my own fields and wrapped myself in a sack intended for dung from the field. As I walked to the temple to seek blessing, my wife stopped me.
"What? Would you bring me more shame? To be seen as such is an abomination."
"Care for Lila and my sons." On the road to the temple, people averted their gaze from me. Some openly turned their backs, making a big show of their disdain. Let them mock. I knocked upon the temple gate, begged entry. The elder approached, head bowed. He showed me the palm of his hand. "No, brother, you cannot come here. I would speak to God.
You cannot step into this place."
"I set the stone for this place." He shook his head at me, the way a reproachful father might touch his willful child.
"Repent your sin, brother. Your folly finds you out."
"My sin? How dare you speak to me? Who shares your bed, elder?" His face in fury first, then he gathered his robes and retreated behind the walls, leaving me outside the gate my own hands had built. Just 2 days before, he would have thrown open the welcome with trumpets and songs, but now, repent. But what is my sin? I asked the unanswered darkness this question that night. "Lord, tell me my wrong. Show me mine transgression. Speak to me. Once more, speak to me. The cock crowed. No footsteps. No sharp knocks on the door, not at first, just wailing. Wailing heard around my grounds. I covered my ears to purchase a few more seconds before catastrophe. My wife ran into the room, eyes wide with panic. She ripped the blanket from Lila's pallet as there lay the baby, perfectly still, unmoving. Lips blue as the morning sky. No! My whole being became a long, unending scream. I tried to push my breath into hers. Take me, Lord! Take me instead! I held her tight to will my own warmth to hers, please. But he would not give her back to me. In the night, with one slash of his side, he had taken my baby girl and her 10 brothers as well. Thief! Murderer! God! The servants fled. Childhood friends debated my curse. My wife, her beautiful raven hair turned suddenly silver. She wandered the forest as if hoping to find the children under a rock, in a stream, climbing a tree. The next morning, a new plague. My skin became racked with boils and lesions. I scarcely noticed. I no longer bowed. I sat. This was no prayer. This was a demand. Speak to me. You will speak to me now. No food. No water. I ate only hatred. My wife insisted that I curse your God. Curse him and die. But curses were for children. I would have revenge. Speak to me. Speak to me. Day and night, speak to me. In my delirium, I thought I heard a serpent laughing. I heard the cock crow on the fourth morning, surely to announce some new calamity, but I barely could lift my head in witness. And then finally, I heard the voice. His voice. Look. Look and see. I lifted my head to note a glowing tornado of fire dancing above the city. A tornado with no wind. I am the Lord your God, the tornado said. The creator of firmaments, the destroyer of mountains. It was a happy voice, a clean voice, a voice after a laugh. Do not presume to know my ways. You are as nothing. But do not fear. I will multiply all that I took from you. You shall have more lands, more cattle, and more children. For I am the Lord your God. You are no God to me. And the tornado went away. Wait. Wait. The things the tornado said came to pass. My harvest was bountiful. My flock stretched out like the sea. My wife, she gave me more children. 10 sons. And once again, she held her head high in the marketplace, servants trailing after her. And only I heard her sobs at night. One day, Striding through the forest, I heard a chuckle. I looked down at the grass and saw a serpent. I knew him.
"You cost me dearly,"
the serpent laughed. "What do you mean, Satan?"
"I bet him I could break you, but you are more hard-headed than I imagined."
"Why?"
"We like to have our fun, too."
I know the serpent is a liar, but I also know that this is the truth. Sport. I was just sport.
"And congratulations on the new daughter."
"I don't have a new daughter." The serpent chuckled anew.
"Not yet."
"I will not be toyed with, serpent."
"Yes, you will, Joe. You are his plaything. Unless..."
"Unless what?"
"Unless..."
"Tell me what you know, serpent."
"Tell me what you'll give me, Joe."
"For this knowledge, for the knowledge necessary to bring my tormentor low, I would grant him my eternal soul." The laughter, it grew louder around me. You see, I didn't want my enemy to grant me a new daughter. I wanted the daughter I already had. And whoever took her from me, whoever stole my Lila, they're gonna pay. Even if they are God. It's that time. We've almost run out of crumbs in the forest, but don't worry. There's plenty more goodies to get you all the way to the gingerbread house. Just go to snapjudgment.org. Keep Snap rolling with the amazing podcast featuring over 100 full episodes for free. Are you kidding me? See pictures, movies, stuff. Join Snap on Facebook, on Twitter, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, Android. Get it your way, Snappers. Snap was produced by a team far too smart to place themselves in the path of a raging bull. Say hello to the great and powerful Oz himself, the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Wistich. Yeah! Pat, Uncle Henry with C. Miller, Anna, Dorothy Sussman, the Scarecrow, Julia DeWitt, Joe the Tin Woodman Rosenberg, Nancy the Cowardly Lion Lopez, starring Davy Kim as Glinda the Good Witch. And Gregorio, cameos as the Gatekeeper. The Evil Witch of the West, none other than Jasmine Aguilera, Oompa Loompas, well, that's a different story, but it's Laura Soria, Eliza Smith, Leon Morimoto, and Anna Adlerstein. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could fly your hot air balloon to a mysterious land, declare yourself president for life, only to have your plans ruined by a cute little girl, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.